Okay, so today in my lecture, in the final lecture, I'd like to talk about superpotentials in quantum mechanics. And so in some sense, these are deformations of supersymmetric quantum mechanics in the same sense that Davide was discussing yesterday. And in my talk today, I want to consider some particular examples of those deformations. And in fact, I want to talk about finite deformations and a particular class of finite deformations that come from what physicists call superpotentials. And so these are going to actually be flat deformations. And so the idea that we're going to try to use is to use that flatness to find easier ways to compute things in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So we're going to introduce a parameter and try to take that parameter to, say, infinity, where we have a much simpler description of the system. Okay, but I just want to begin by saying a few things about deformations and types of deformations that we have. So first of all, what we're going to do is to be, I'll use the same notation that Davide used yesterday. We're going to be deforming the differential by some element x. And so x here should be some element of my operator algebra in degree 1. And in order to preserve the fact that this differential still squares to 0, which was one of my supersymmetry equations, then then this element should obey the Mara-Kartan equation. Which basically says the following. Or if I write it out. It looks like this. And so this is the Mara-Kartan equation for my DG algebra of local operators in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So today I want to consider two particular types of deformations. And they're going to be finite deformations. And the two types are going to be roughly related to deformations that involve complex parameters or real parameters. And so the focus of my talk is going to be on the second case, when the parameters are real. But I just want to mention and give a couple of examples of the complex case first. So the first type are when you have some complex parameters. So I could call them u. They live in some, they parameterize some complex space, big U. And the superchargers depend on those parameters in such a way that they're holomorphic. And so if I think about, so now what I can imagine is that I move around in this parameter space and I get a family of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And I'd like to know what structures that endows, for example, the space of states or the space of operators with. So the first thing to say is that if I look at my my complex of states, so that's what I denoted by omega with differential q, then this is going to become a complex of holomorphic vector bundles. On this parameter space. And in particular, if I then try to pass to the cohomology, well, this might be a subtle thing to do, but then I'd like to try and take the cohomology of this complex, and so should perhaps think about my Hilbert space of supersymmetric vacua as a coherent sheaf on U. So this is the kind of thing that physicists would call introducing a Berry connection. We have a quantum mechanics depending on, or family of quantum mechanics depending on some parameters, and we're interested in how the structures behave as I vary those parameters. So let me give you a couple of examples coming from things that I've already talked about. So the first example I want to give is in this Hermitian model, where I had a Hermitian manifold X together with a Hermitian vector bundle E. And just to remind you, in this model, my supercharge Q was basically given by the Dolbeau operator acting on sections of E. And so there's a natural deformation of this type, which is to deform the complex structure of my bundle E. So what does that mean? It means that I make some deformation of my D bar operator. And the Mauer-Cartan equation in this case is just going to become the usual thing that such deformation should obey, an equation like this. So that's an example of such a deformation. I could have done the same thing, for example, for the complex structure on my target space X. It would have been similar. Okay, I just want to give one more example of that, of this, which is slightly more involved. So my second example takes exactly the same model, this Hermitian model, but we're going to enrich it a little bit with some more structure. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take E, our holomorphic vector bundle, and we're going to promote it to a Z-graded bundle. So in particular, I might write it with a decomposition like this. And then in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, we're going to define a new fermion number, which was the old one, namely the form degree on the target, together, summed together with the additional grading I've put on the bundle. So. So we take a new fermion number F, which is basically going to be form degree, and then plus P. And now what I'm going to do is to make a deformation of my supercharge, Q. So I'm going to take Q now to be what it was before, the Dolbeau operator on E. But then I'm going to add to it a holomorphic differential delta. So here, delta is a holomorphic differential. Okay, it should have degree one. And then after I've done that deformation, the space of supersymmetric ground states is now going to become basically the hypercohomology of this complex. So maybe I was a bit quick there. What I meant was that the delta is a holomorphic differential on this, on my complex of vector bundles here. And the space of supersymmetric ground states will become the hypercohomology of this complex. So perhaps just for physicists, I can say that this is this setup here, this type of deformation, is exactly what physicists would call E and J type superpotentials. And a supersymmetric quantum mechanics of 0-2 type. And the fact that this delta is a differential that it squares to zero is the usual condition on the ENJ type superpotentials. Okay, so that's my first type of deformation. They depend on complex parameters, and that's all I'm going to say about this class. So the main thrust of what I want to say today involves another type that involve real parameters. Okay, so type two, we're going to introduce some real parameters. Yes. Well, I think I wanted. I wanted it so I can add a differential of degree one, so I have a notion of degree acting on the bundle, on sections of the bundle.
To allow your differential to move between different components.
Yes.
Of the speed.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Is that more experimental?
Yeah, I guess the ENJ would be a particular example of this. So if I were to add some fermions, I might take E dot here to be, say, exterior powers of some other holomorphic vector bundle F. And then the E and J would kind of act from backwards and forwards between the. So the E and J terms is really a special case when you take something of this type. It's like what you get from quantizing fermions.
So would delta be made of E?
Yeah, delta would be something like, very schematically, it would be something like. Sorry? I think it should, yeah, if you choose the R charges of the E and J appropriately. Yes. And the fact that this squares to zero is related to the usual type of condition that we might write down. Yep.
You are talking about two types of finite deformations.
Yeah.
What does infinite deformation mean in the first case?
It doesn't mean anything in the first case. I mean, I'm not going to consider infinite.
What does it mean in general, infinite deformation? How would you define infinite deformation?
I'll come to that, if that's okay. Okay. If I don't answer that later, then feel free to. Okay, so my second type are going to depend on some real parameters. So we'll call those parameters lambda, and they'll be valued in some real space, big lambda. And so in this case, the superchargers will depend on this parameter lambda in the following way. If I take a derivative with respect to lambda, this is given by a Q commutator with some other fixed operator that I'll call H. So here, H should be a self-adjoint degree zero. And this kind of deformation is in some sense flat, because the change in the supercharge is given again by a Q commutator. So if I were to expand this out order by order, I would have something like Q0 plus lambda times the commutator of Q0 with H, and so on and so forth. And it's easy to check that this satisfies, this kind of thing satisfies the Mal-Cartan equation automatically. So the nice thing about this is, because the variation of the supercharge is itself the Q variation of something, this is a flat deformation. And so I think we expect the space of supersymmetric ground states to be something like a local system. Lambda. So I want to point something out, or make a note here, which I think is important, which is, when you're considering the allowed spaces of deformation parameters here, you have to be really careful to make sure that your system remains gapped, and you should remove points where the system may become ungapped. So just to give an example. It might be that we should take this parameter space to be something like the real line minus the origin, because what happens is, at the origin of the real line, the quantum mechanics gets massless degrees of freedom, and it's not gapped anymore. And so you should remove that point. And so, very roughly, what you would expect to find in such a situation is a space of supersymmetric vacua on one side, and perhaps a very different space of supersymmetric vacua on the other side. This kind of thing leads to a wall crossing phenomena, where the Hilbert space can jump across, say, codimension one walls in the space of parameters. I'm not sure. I think so.
What's the relation between those two Hilbert spaces? Is there a map between them, or is there an algebra that acts on both of them? I mean, wall crossing, whenever I see wall crossing, I want it to mean that there's some way to relate one of them from the other. If I know one and I know some information that's happening.
Yeah. I think ideally, yes, but I'm certainly not going to talk about that in any detail today.
Can you give us a hint? Like, what, is there any way, like, so I can't know what's happening at zero, because, like, I mean, something bad happens because my theory picks up a bunch of new massless modes.
Yes.
How do I deal with that? How can I, like, see those modes somehow?
I don't know how to answer that question in general. I don't know if anyone else can say anything better than me, but I'm going to give an example of exactly this setup in the talk later on. Maybe that will help. But I just wanted to point out that this is something to be aware of, that we should remove points from this parameter space where the system may not be gapped. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples, and these are the two main examples that I'm going to talk about in the rest of the talk. So my first example is the Riemannian model. And this is the classic example. So we have a Riemannian manifold X. And we deform the theory by turning on a Morse function. H. And so given that Morse function, we modify our supercharge. So we take Q. Q before was given by the Darboux operator, sorry, the Durham operator. And what we do is we now take that to be a conjugated version of the Durham operator. So in particular, if I just expand that out, I get D plus DH wedge. Sorry, lambda times dH wedge. Okay. So my second example is in the Hermitian model, and it's of a very similar form, except we're going to turn on a very particular Morse function, which arises from a moment map for a flavor symmetry. So in the Hermitian model, we're going to assume, just like we did in the previous lecture, that this model has a U1 flavor symmetry. And so we make a few additional assumptions now compared to last time. So in particular, I'm just going to assume that x is Kähler. And, well, I'm also going to assume that U1 has isolated fixed points. And in this case, we're going to take the function h to be given by the moment map for this action. This is why I decided to take this to be Kähler. And so in particular, I can define a moment map. And in this case, the supercharge gets deformed in a very similar way. So before, my supercharge was given by a Darboux operator. And now exactly the same thing happens. It gets conjugated by some factor like this. And so if I expand it out, it would look something like that. So these are the two main models that I'm gonna try to discuss in today's lecture. And so let me say what the idea is. So the first thing is that these are supposed to be flat deformations. So the idea is that provided the system remains gapped, then I should be able to vary this parameter, and the space of supersymmetric vacua should be essentially the same. And we want to utilize that fact to get a different description of the system. And in particular, what we're going to try to do is to send the system off to infinity. In one of these directions. So this doesn't sound very well defined, but I'll try to make it more so as time goes on. So the idea is that we want to send this parameter to infinity, and we want it to exploit flatness. To get, let's say, a useful description. Of the space of supersymmetric ground states. Okay. Okay, are there any questions? Otherwise, I'm going to go dive straight in and look at the two examples. Okay, so 3.2 is going to be the Riemannian model. And this is exactly the type of model that was discussed by Witten in supersymmetry and Morse theory. And so, just a reminder, I'm going to turn on a Morse function, H. And I want to give you some intuition about what happens when I take the parameter in front of that superpotential to be very large. So the intuition is the following. The potential of the theory, potential energy, if you like, has a term that looks like the mod squared of D of H. And so what this means is that the idea is that as I try to take lambda to be very large, then the idea is that the system will localize to the critical points. Of H. So the idea is that in my sigma model, I'm putting a potential on top of that. And when I take lambda to be very large, that potential becomes very steeply concentrated near the critical points of H. And so perhaps to a first approximation, at least perturbatively, I can understand the system by zooming in on the neighborhood of those fixed points and looking at the contributions there. Just a very schematic picture. If I have a critical point, then what I'm really doing is, you know, I'm making this potential very steep near that critical point. Okay, so let me then describe what I'll call a local model, which means that I'm going to zoom in on a neighborhood of one of these points and try to solve the problem there, to find the space of supersymmetric ground states and so on. So in this case, this is just what physicists call the simple harmonic oscillator, possibly one of the simplest examples of a quantum mechanics. So in the neighborhood of a point, x will just look like, say, r. And if I expand out my Morse function, then it will look like some constant plus lambda over 2 times the second derivative times x squared. So let me just introduce a bit of notation and write that so it looks like a simple harmonic oscillator. With some parameter omega. Omega is the frequency. Okay, so what do the superchargers look like when I do this? Well, let's have a look at Q and Q dagger. So Q looks like the following. We now have the Dolbeau operator, which is just essentially ddx. And then we add to that the derivative of the superpotential, which is omega x. And then the adjoint of that looks like the following. There's also a derivative with respect to x with the opposite sign. And then I have the contraction operator with ddx like this. OK, so what do the Suzy ground states look like? We know what Q and Q dagger are. If we're interested in computing the space of supersymmetric ground states, we can do that completely explicitly in this model. They're given by the intersection of the kernel of Q with the kernel of Q dagger, wave functions that are annihilated by both, and are also normalizable. And what you find, and this will be an exercise, is that there's one state one solution to these conditions. Given by the following. So in the first case, we have to distinguish the two cases when omega is greater than zero and omega is less than zero. I'm going to remove the case when omega is zero because that's exactly when it looks like a free particle. That's not gapped. So in the first case, I get a Gaussian wave function. And it's a zero form. And in the second case, I get a Gaussian wave function again. And this time, it's a one form. So the crucial thing to notice here is that whether we got, in this simple model, where I'm just picking like one direction, whether I got a zero-form contribution or a one-form contribution depended on the sign here in front of the quadratic term. So now more generally, when I look at a focus on the neighborhood of some general critical point, every time there's a, for every positive eigenvalue of my Hessian, I'm going to get zero forms, and for every negative eigenvalue, I'm going to get one forms. So what this model tells us is that at a general critical point, P, there's always going to be one state, which is just going to be a product of factors that look like this. And that if the Morse index of that critical point, which is the number of negative eigenvalues of the Hessian, is NP, then we'll get one state. Which will be an NP form. Okay, so what I can do now is I can write down, if you like, a first approximation to my space of supersymmetric ground states. So I'm going to call this HI PERT, which is just by adding up all of the contributions from all of the critical points. So we take a direct sum over critical points such that their Morse index is given by the index I, and then we just have a copy of C corresponding to this kind of wave function. And the idea is that as I take lambda to be larger and larger, the potential becomes steeper and steeper. And so if I try to formally take lambda to be very large, these should become exact ground states of the system, at least in perturbation theory. However, there can also be non-perturbative corrections on top of this. And these come from instanton corrections. So what these instanton corrections are going to do is to essentially add an extra differential on top of this. They're going to remove some of the states. One way to see that this has to be true is that, or there has to be something like this going on, is that this is supposed to be a flat deformation. So the result at the end of the day is not supposed to depend on lambda or which Morse function I choose. And I might choose a different Morse function and get different numbers of critical points with different Morse indices. And they can't all equal the same result. So there has to be some additional corrections something extra going on that removes states, such that we always get the same answer. And these are coming from instanton corrections. So I'm not going to try to explain exactly where they come from, although they can be derived by considering the path integral, for example, for this quantum mechanics. I'm just going to tell you what they look like. And so instanton corrections are going to come from solutions to the gradient flow equations for this Morse function. So these are equations that look like this. So G here is the metric on X. And solutions of these equations are called gradient flows. And I think it's clear from the equations that these kind of flows are always going to start and end at critical points, assuming they start and end somewhere. So a typical solution might look something like this. Okay, and the idea is that this leads to a further differential acting on these states, acting on this, which turn this into a complex. So let me write down what that looks like. So the idea is that if I act with my differential on some on the state associated to some fixed point P, then I'm going to get a contribution from all other fixed points that for which there exist gradient flows connecting the two, solutions of these equations connecting the two. Now, the solutions of those equations will only exist if the Morse index of the point P prime that I'm the critical point P prime that I'm trying to flow to is one higher than the original point. And so you get a sum over critical points P prime such that NP prime is given by NP plus 1. And then there's some numbers, NP primed, and then states associated to those fixed points, sorry, those critical points. And so this number is essentially counting the number of flows that exist between these two points. So it counts with signs that I'm not going to try to define. The number of gradient flows from P to P primed. So this is just to give you an idea of the kind of thing that happens in these models and how you might go about computing them. Let me give you a very silly example that goes back to my particle on a circle, just to give you an idea of how these computations go. So we look at a particle on a circle. Okay, here's my circle. And what we're going to take is that H, we're going to be, in the literal way that I've drawn it on the board, we can take H to be the height function for this circle. Okay, so then there are two critical points that I could call P and P prime. In this case, P has Morse index 0, and P prime has Morse index 1. So there are going to be two states in perturbation theory, one coming from P, which will be a naught form, and one coming from P prime, that will be a one form. Now, on the other hand, H is just the height function here. So there are two gradient flows going from P to P prime, one around this side and one around this side. And what happens in this case is the contribution from those two gradient flows just cancels out. So there might be a differential that takes me from P to P primed that in this case, this NPP is basically given by 1 minus 1 is 0. I didn't exactly tell you how to deal with the signs, but in this case, the two contributions from the two flows cancel out exactly. And this agrees with the cohomology, the Durham cohomology of a circle, which has one element in degree 1, degree 0. So that's a silly example, but it hopefully at least gives you an idea of the kind of thing that you should do. And maybe I should say that the reason I'm covering this topic very quickly is that it's covered like really thoroughly in this big mirror symmetry book. So if you want to see lots of examples and more explanations and where this comes from, then that's a good place to look. Or, of course, Witten's original paper. What I want to move on to is something that I think is less well known, which is how this works in the case of the Hermitian model that I mentioned. And I'm going to try to follow the same kind of idea and the same kind of logic to compute supersymmetric ground states in this Hermitian type models. Okay, so let me again state my assumptions, just to be clear. So we're going to be interested in turning on a Morse function, which is a moment map for some isometry. So to have that moment map, we're going to take x to be Kähler. And we're going to assume that there's a U1 isometry with isolated fixed points. And in this case, we take our Morse function to be literally given by the moment map. For the action of U1 on x. And the idea that I'm going to use is exactly the same one. So we're going to try to take this parameter in front of the superpotential to be very large. And the idea is that just like before, the system will localize to the critical points. Of this Morse function. But in this case, the critical points of the Morse function are exactly just the fixed points of the U1 action. So this is already smelling like some kind of localization formula, some kind of equivariant localization formula. Okay, so just like before, what I'm going to do is to zoom in on the neighborhood of a fixed point and solve the model there, and then lift that up to the full case. So my local model, in this case, is again something that's what physicists would call perhaps a complex simple harmonic oscillator. It's very similar. So in particular, I can take my space X to just look like C this time. And we take our Morse function. Well, OK. This is acted upon in an obvious way by U1 rotations. Whose fixed point is the origin. And the Morse function, at least up to a constant of proportionality, is given by half omega, this time times mod of z squared, where z is my coordinate, my complex coordinate. Actually, I think in this case, I'm going to remove the half to make my life a bit easier. OK, what do the superchargers look like? Well, they should be deformations of the Dolbeau operator and its adjoint. So they look something like this. First, there's a dz bar, because it's a Dolbeau operator. And then I add to that dz bar of the superpotential, which is just omega times z. And the adjoint of that is given by a similar expression. Looks like the following. Now, in the Durham case, for each fixed point, in my local model, I just had a single state, a single supersymmetric ground state. That was really because it was a Durham operator. In this case, it's Dolbeau, it's dz bar. And so this time we're going to have actually an entire Fock space of states. We're going to have all, say, polynomials in Z. So again, this is going to be an exercise to check that the normalizable supersymmetric ground states are given by the following. So for my fixed point P, there's now going to be a whole tower of states. And what that tower looks like will again depend on the sign of this parameter, whether it's positive or negative. We remove the origin because it's not gapped. And so in this case, they're given by not just a Gaussian wave function, but actually any polynomial or monomial, multiplying that. And likewise, when omega is less than zero, we're going to get polynomials in z bar. And here, n runs over anything greater than or equal to zero. So there's a whole tower of states, a whole Fock space associated to each fixed point in this case. But the main idea is exactly the same, is that for each positive eigenvalue of my Hessian, I'm going to get something that looks like polynomials in Z in those directions. And for each negative eigenvalue, I'm going to get something which looks like polynomials in Z bar times dz bar. Okay, so what that means to a fixed point of index NP, we're going to associate a whole Fock space in perturbation theory, which looks like the following. So again, there's going to be a sum over those fixed points whose index is actually equal to the thing that I want. And then now for each positive eigenvalue, so A equals 1 up to N minus NP, I'm going to get some Fock space that I'll call F plus. And then for each negative eigenvalue, I'm going to get some copy of the Fox space that I'll call F minus. So here, this is what I'm calling F plus, and this is what I'm calling F minus. And just like before, the claim is that if I take lambda to be very large, then these are exact perturbative ground states. However, just like before, there may well be instanton corrections that I have to consider. And we should worry about exactly where those instantons are coming from. The supercharged, the Q and the Q dagger annihilate all of these things. Okay. Okay, so just like before, there can be instanton corrections. But the instanton corrections are coming from a different set of equations now. So whereas before we had some real gradient flow equations, this time the set of equations we're going to study look a little different. So in local coordinates, they look like this, dz d tau. And now I have my Hermitian metric, or its inverse, on the target. And then I have this contribution here. Maybe I should say one thing before I describe the instanton corrections. It's clear already that in this complex case, the instanton corrections have to be much more dramatic, because we know, for example, if I have a compact space, my Dolbeau cohomology at the end of the day, the thing that I'm trying to get to should be finite dimensional. Whereas here, I'm giving you like an infinite number of states at each fixed point. So the cancellations coming from instanton corrections have to be much more dramatic in this case. So in principle, what you could do is to perform a similar analysis to what you would do in the Morse theory case by studying the path integral of the theory and trying to argue about how solutions of these equations provide differentials. I don't actually know how, yes?
So next one we could have had a band, right? So if the Z bar was more helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah, H is not a section of the bundle, so I don't see how the bundle appears. That is confusing. What I'm going to do is not to try to solve this equation. Okay? I'm going to describe something else, some approach that's more algebraic. And when I do that, how to keep track of the bundle will be clear. But I don't know the answer to your question, okay? Because I'm not going to solve this equation. Okay. So in principle, I could try to perform a similar kind of analysis, trying to find the solutions to these equations, understand how they contribute a differential. But what I'm going to instead give you is a more algebraic approach. Which will be not at all rigorous, although I think it can be made so. And this is something that I learned from a really nice paper of Frenkel. Losev and Nekrasov, called Instantons Beyond Topological Field Theory. Okay, so I'm going to describe exactly what this algebraic approach is in three steps. It's a bit like a trick, but then once I've done the trick, I'll try to be a bit more precise about what it means. So here's step one. Step one is we're going to try to get rid of those nasty Gaussians, prefactors. So step one is we're going to do a conjugation. What do I mean by that? I mean that we're going to define a set of in wave functions, which you get from the normal ones by multiplying by e to the lambda h. Likewise, we're going to have a set of out wave functions defined by the opposite thing. And we're also going to conjugate all of our operators. So this is something that you can actually implement by adding a topological term to the action. But the idea is that correlation functions are, well, okay, maybe I should say that once I've done this, my Hilbert space structure becomes something more like a map from the space of in-states times the, maybe the other way around, the space of out-states times the space of in-states to C. So, in other words, these two sets of things are going to be naturally paired up. Of course, when I do that, these factors are going to cancel and give me the original thing. Okay, so in trying to discuss the states, I could work with either the in-states or the out-states. And so I'm going to focus on the in-ones. Okay, so that's step one. Step two.
Can you say out loud again what happened in step one? What was step one?
Step one is I will make a definition. That's all. Whenever I have a wave function or a state, I will define the in version of that to be this and the out version to be that. Okay. That's pretty much all I'm going to say. That's all step one is. Okay.
Did you have lambda in definition?
Yes, thank you.
And that expectation is like the pairing we already had on our
numbers. Exactly, yeah. It's just going to become the one we had before. Because if I put an out state here and an in state here, then these guys will cancel out. That's the idea. So anytime I want to compute like a correlation function, a number, it's going to give exactly the same kind of thing.
And it's just to make sure these psi in and psi out and the interpretive Hilbert space you wrote down.
Yeah. So step two, I'm now going to take lambda to infinity, in some sense literally or strictly. So I'm actually going to try and take the limit of my wave functions. And the point of doing this conjugation first is that having done that, I tend to remove these annoying Gaussian factors. So I get something that looks more like algebraic, like polynomials in Z or something like that. So in the local model, what do these things look like? So let me take my states here that I've got written there. Let me do this conjugation. So these are now the in states. I'm just not going to write in everywhere. And then I'm going to literally take the limit of these things as lambda goes to infinity. And once you do that, these limits can actually become well-defined. So in particular, if omega is greater than zero, by doing the conjugation on the instate, I'm literally removing the Gaussian. And all I get is z to the n. No, I'm combining, I'm combining lambda with like the second derivative of h at the critical point, and that's what I'm calling omega in there.
Omega's kind of like the charge of the fixed point.
Yeah. It's the coefficient in front of x squared. Yeah. So, I mean, omega is becoming very large here, if you like. Maybe I should write like this. Okay, so on the other hand, in this case, I'm still going to have to keep my Gaussian. But the thing that you get if you actually take the limit in this case is derivative of delta function states. So if I get the normalizations right, they look like this, d bar of 1 over z to the n plus 1. Now, if I were to have done it with the out states, these would have got switched over. And indeed, polynomials and derivative of delta functions are exactly paired. OK, so that was step two. I did this conjugation. I actually implemented the limit, which was well defined. And step three. Step three is going to be to compute the instance on corrections.
So that should be a 1 over z bar.
No. Okay, so how are we going to compute the instance on corrections? Well, let me do it first for my example, and then I'll explain how it works in general. So let me look at the following example. Let me take x to be CP1. And to keep life easy, let me take e to be the trivial bundle. Okay, so just like in the circle case, here's my picture of P1. And I'm going to do exactly the same as before. So I'm going to take my U1 to act in this way, in the plane orthogonal to the board and parallel to the floor. If I do that, the Morse function that I have is up to a constant, a given by the height function. That's the moment map for this action. And there are two fixed points, just like before, P and P prime. And just like before, they have indices, NP is 0, and NP prime is 1. Let me introduce some local coordinates. In order to write down the wave functions in the neighborhood of each fixed point, let me introduce some local coordinates. So the local coordinate here will be z, and the local coordinate here will be w. On the overlap of patches, they'll be related by z is equal to 1 over w. Then which perturbative ground states do I have? Well, those states coming from p, well, they'll all be zero forms. They'll just be given by z to the n. And from p prime, I'll again have a tower of states, but these guys will look like delta functions. D bar of 1 over the w to the n plus 1. Okay, so now some magic happens. So let me go over to this board here. Let me just take let me just take Q of my states at my first fixed point. Well, that should be zero. And naively it is. If I take d bar of z to the n, that's zero. But it's zero everywhere until I get to the other point. Okay. And in the neighborhood of the other point, I should really change coordinates to w. So I get d bar of 1 over w to the n. And this thing is either 0, if n is equal to 1, or 0, sorry. And it's proportional to my states at the other fixed point, if n is greater than 0. So what's happened? Well, I've got a differential that's connecting and canceling out my towers of Fock spaces now, all except for one state at the bottom. Which is a naught form. Disagrees with the Dolbeau cohomology of P1. It's a single constant function. Which indeed it is, it's 1 in my notation. Let me give you another example. Okay, I'm just going to change the bundle now from, and hopefully this addresses Davide's question, at least from this perspective. Let me change the bundle to OM. Well, all that happens is that I need to include the transition function. So when I redo this calculation that I did above, it looks like the following. If I act on the states at P, that's like d bar of z to the n. But now in transforming to W coordinates, I will pick up an extra transition function, like this. And this thing is now given by 0. If n is less than or equal to m, and it's proportional to the states at the other fixed point. If n is greater than m. You can see that I screwed up my indices slightly here. So n minus 1. So what states do I have left? Well, the only states that I have left are given by the states not removed by the differential are just given by 1, z, z squared, all the way up to zm. Okay, and this coincides with the Dolbeau cohomology of CP1 valued in OM. They're just the sections of OM. Yeah, there's a bit of trickery in going from this to this line to this line. But let me leave that for the problems, perhaps. Okay, so that's the trick. Let me try to explain now what this is doing, or how to reframe this mathematically. Yeah. It's still there, in the sense that there'll still be like differential operators like in the neighborhood of a fixed point that are acting on the states.
He's using the spectral sequence for the
Yes. That's what I'm coming to right now. Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. So indeed I'm about to try to tell you what this means. And so this goes under the name of the growth and decreasing complex. So let me try to explain this in the example. And the first thing I'm going to do is exactly give the BB decomposition. So So in my example, let me draw it again. Here's CP1. Here's my two fixed points, P and P prime. Then the moment map was again like the height function as I draw this on the board. And so the solutions of this equation, or the solutions of my instanton equation, are kind of flowing in this direction. I think you should really regard like the instead of real trajectory flow lines, you should think of the solutions as P1s connecting fixed points. This is a simple example of that. So from this point of view, we have ascending, let's call them ascending manifolds, which are given by everything that ascends from a fixed point. So in this case, x of p would be just given by CP1 subtract p prime, and x of p prime will be just given by p prime. And what I've described as perturbative ground states can be rephrased in terms of local cohomology. So in this case, let me look at the contributions from the two fixed points in particular. So the contribution at degree zero to my perturbative ground states, they were the ones that were coming from P here. So that was basically polynomials in Z. Okay, well this is the same thing as sections of my bundle restricted to XP. Another way to write that is that the local cohomology of E with support on XP. And similarly, the contributions in degree one, they were all coming from the second fixed point P prime. If I ignore the presence of the D bar, I could write this something like this. And another way to frame what this is that the local cohomology in degree one with supports on P prime. These are things that are meromorphic with a pole at P prime. All Okay, and of course in this case, we have the situation where if I take the closure of xp, then xp primed is contained in that. And in that kind of situation, this differential that I've described is exactly called the growth and decousin operator. The differential that does exactly what I'm describing is called the growth and decousin operator. So there's a differential acting like this. So as Ben suggested, let me just flesh out a little bit what the general structure looks like, and then I'll say something even more about the U1 action and flavor symmetries. Okay. So the general picture is the following. We have some ascending manifolds. That I'll call xp, associated to each fixed point. And so these things are basically going to look like c to the n minus np, where np is the index of the fixed point. And these guys give a BB decomposition X. I'm going to assume that this is a stratification. So there's some notion that if I take the closure of XP, then that should be a union of things that look like XP prime, where these guys have codimension 1. I don't know under what assumptions this decomposition is a stratification. I don't know if... Sorry, Ben?
I believe you that sort of only the codimension one things contribute.
Yeah.
Only codimension one things.
Uh-huh.
That one was never.
Okay.
Right, I mean, that doesn't happen in DBM. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Maybe this condition is not correct. Well, okay. At least the perturbative ground states are supposed to be given by the following thing. So H perturbative in degree I will be given by a sum over all of those fixed points that have index I. And then we take the local cohomology with supports on XP in degree I. And then the differential will again be given by some sum of these growth and decousin operators, which happen, I think, whenever one ascending manifold is in the closure of another, there'll be an operator of this type. Okay, So the general idea is that we use this kind of decomposition. So in the final few minutes of the talk, I would just want to point out a connection to geometric representation theory, which goes back to flavor symmetries that we discussed last time. Okay, so 3.5, geometric representation theory. So again, let me just go back to my example of CP1. And so something we discussed previously was that in these Dolbeau type models, in the Hermitian models, if I compute the supersymmetric ground states, they should transform in representations of the flavor symmetry. Now in this case, the full flavor symmetry of this theory is given by SU2. And the Hilbert space here is transforming in a finite dimensional irreducible representation of SU2. So in particular, this is the n plus 1 dimensional representation. Okay, so what I've done in writing the space of supersymmetric ground states in this way is I've expressed this finite dimensional representation of SU2 as the cohomology of some other complex. And so we can recognize the terms in that complex. So the instanton complex that we had in this case, well, we just had things in degree 0 and degree 1. So it looked something like this. Well, if you examine exactly how the operators in the quantum mechanics that generate the action of this SU2, how they act locally on the states at these two fixed points, they're just Fermi modules. And in realizing the space of supersymmetric ground states in this way, all that I've really done here is to give the BGG resolution. Of this representation. Okay. Question? Maybe I can just say very briefly what the general story is, also, although probably at this point it's... it's fairly clear. So I think this was done in a paper of Kempf from back in, I think, 78. So the idea is that we just generalize this to the case where X is given by G mod B, where B is some Borel subgroup. So we take H to be a moment map for a U1 inside of some torus inside of B, and it should be generic. In this case, the critical points are just given by elements of the Weyl group of G. My ascending manifolds, these are given by Schubert cells. And if we choose a line bundle, so if we choose E to be a line bundle labeled by some dominant integral weight, or highest dominant integral weight, then the instanton complex is exactly going to give the BGG resolution. Finite dimensional representation labeled by the weight lambda. Okay, I think that's all I have to say. Thank you. Okay, questions? No, it's not. No.
Where is that?
So I think you can have a look in the. I learned it from this paper of Frenkel and Losev and Nekrasov, and if you. They don't discuss exactly the model that I talked about. Actually, it's a much more complicated one, but it's in there.